Great to have you along here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and we're beginning our program today by talking with you about Nature's Garden. That's the title of a book written by Samuel Thayer of Birchwood, Wisconsin. He's an internationally recognized authority on wild edible plants. He's been doing it since childhood. He's offered educational workshops for the past 14 years. And we had him on the program, it's probably in 2006 or thereabouts, when his first book, The Forager's Harvest, came out. It won 3 awards. He's been inducted into the National Wild Food Hall of Fame in West Virginia. And so it's really great to have him back to talk about wild edible plants. And what a great time to do it as we get into the spring season. Plants are starting to come up, those wild plants, and many of them are edible, as he will tell you. You could join in with your own questions and comments at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Sam Thayer with us by phone. Sam, hi.
Hi, Larry. Good morning, and thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, it's great to have you back. It's a real garden out there, isn't it?
It really is. When you start learning what foods are edible, the whole outdoor starts to look different.
I tell you, I really like your new book. The photography is phenomenal, and the descriptions that you have of the edibles is amazing as well. And you've got 500 pages worth here. And not all those plants can be found in Wisconsin, can they?
Well, there's 41 plants covered, and there's only one that's actually not found in Wisconsin. So it's almost totally applicable here.
Okay. How did you happen to put the book together?
Well, in terms of the types of plants that I put in it?
Yeah,
or?
I just wondered what induced you to write the book.
Well, you know, it's just been a passion of mine for my whole life, and I... you know, the whole project started years ago, probably 12 years ago, and it started out by producing The Forager's Harvest, my first book. But when I was working on that book, I realized that the depth that I wanted to cover these plants with, there was no way that I could fit that many plants into one book. So right off the bat, I divided it into 3 volumes because I didn't want it to be... The first book is my favorite plants, and the second book is my second favorite plants, and the third book is plants that are kind of okay. I want it, you know, so I really divided it up to begin with, and I just have had this passion for foraging, and I recognized really when I was, you know, probably 12 or 13 years old that it seemed like there was a deficiency in the literature. I certainly had a lot of trouble figuring things out when I was learning, and so as I learned those things, I wanted to be able to give people a shortcut so they didn't have to spend as much time learning as I did. And yeah. So that's what I did.
And it's interesting to me that you got started at this at such a young age. You know, most kids probably aren't thinking along the lines of wild edible plants when they're 10, 11 years old.
Yeah, you know, I don't know why it was such a passion for me. I joke that I just was hungry, and that was probably part of it. But I remember walking to and from school, and we had about a 2.5-mile walk, and I just wanted to snack on something on the way to and from school. So I'd get my field guides, and I'd identify the plants, and I'd say, "Oh, I can try this." And until November when the last berries were frozen off the trees, and then starting again in late March when the first plants were coming up, I was always nibbling something on the way to or from school. And
turned into a career.
Yeah, I didn't expect it to, but it has.
Oh, boy. Well, we have callers online to visit with you, but before we get to Ken and Louise, maybe you could describe for us how your book is organized.
Well, I have a fairly lengthy introduction that gives people, you know, the background information of what you would need to know to get into this hobby of foraging. I talk about the history of foraging, maybe some interesting philosophical discussions about foraging, and, you know, the big question of am I going to poison myself and how to simply, how to be safe and feel safe and where to forage and that kind of stuff. And then the bulk of the book is composed of these 41 different plant accounts, which really, rather than covering an enormous number of plants like a field guide that gives one or two sentences about how the plant is used or what the edible part is, I really try to go into the detail that makes the plant seem real, like it's a real fruit or vegetable. Enough information that somebody would feel comfortable the first time they would use that plant. So there's anywhere from 4 pages to 20 or more pages about individual plants, and I've tried to provide good photographs and accurate descriptions, particularly for the ones that are maybe somewhat confusing in their identification, really to give someone way beyond what a field guide provides. But of course, what I had to cut out was I couldn't cover every plant I wanted to cover. So there's only 41 covered, but they're covered very thoroughly.
Very thoroughly. With some, the photography's absolutely beautiful. Did you do the photography yourself? Or?
I did. Yeah. And what my vision was, I wanted to get pictures of plants that got people excited. I want people to say, wow, that looks like a real big vegetable. Or that looks succulent. I mean, I wanted the pictures of blueberries that made people's mouth water. I wanted it to show abundance, and I wanted it to look attractive like food. And I also needed to show all these different parts that you might need to look at to identify the plant. So there's as many as 20 photos in some of the chapters where I'm showing comparative photos to differentiate one plant from another. But I really had a lot of fun with the photography for this volume.
I bet you did, and you've come up with some wonderful photography. And believe me, those blueberries and pretty much everything else in there looks very, very good to eat. Let's go to Ken, and Teresa has been waiting, or Teresa. Sorry, Ken, hello.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I was out foraging some morels yesterday, and I'm sure this is all covered in your preface of the book. I'm probably a good example of being cautious. I couldn't find any morels, but I got pretty excited. I thought it was I was finding some ramps, and I identified them. They were a little different than what I normally see. They very strong oniony smell and flavor, but anyway, I ate. We cooked them up and ate them. The other person I was with, is a little nauseous today. But I was just wondering, is it? When you eat a lot of certain plants, is it possible that some people can get a different reaction from them? Or,
sure.
Because I obviously ate way more than what the other person had, but she's not feeling the best today.
Okay.
Well, that's an interesting question, and we have cultural norms for every one of our cultivated plants. We know how much is appropriate, so you'd never sit down to dinner and be served a cup and a half of garlic for dinner. But people, when they collect wild foods, sometimes get really excited, and they forget that each food has a normal proportion in the diet and a normal application in the diet, and I have heard of a fair number of cases where someone got an upset stomach or something because they just were so excited to have collected some plant. It may be a plant that they really enjoy finding or that they've searched for a long time, and they're, wow, I found this. I'm going to eat some. And then they eat more than they would normally eat of it because they're so excited, and get sick, or at least, get upset stomach. However, that kind of thing is very rare. But it does happen. And there's always the possibility that, there are some people that onions or garlic will give them an upset stomach. So there's always the possibility that a particular plant disagrees with a particular person. Lots of people enjoy elderberries, but a few people will get an upset stomach from elderberries. So as long as you know you have the right plant, that's a slight risk, I guess, when you're ingesting any new food, whether it's wild or cultivated.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call, Ken. And I want to give Louise a chance to join in from Eagle. Louise, hi.
Hi. I have a question about chicory tea. I I heard that my grandmother used to make a tea out of the chicory weed, but I don't know what part of the weed was used for that. And also, is there caffeine in that tea? I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay, Louise, that's a really good question. Now, the chicory is related to dandelion, although the flower looks quite dissimilar. And the part that's traditionally used is the root, and the root is roasted till it's kind of a light or dark brown, depending on your preference. And then it's ground up and brewed like coffee. It does not have caffeine, and some people really like chicory, and some people consider it a very poor adulterant to coffee, depends on the opinion. I actually prefer the same drink made from dandelion root over chicory, but I use both and like both. To get the chicory roots, they're best in early spring or in when most of their nutrients are stored in the root rather than being invested in the top of the plant. It's you would brew it exactly as you'd brew coffee.
Oh, okay. So easy enough done. I'm trying to remember back to reading some of the old Civil War history and so forth. I think when chicory was often used back in those times.
Yeah, at times when the when there was a problem getting access to coffee supplies, or when coffee got very expensive historically, chicory was used instead of coffee. And we think of chicory as a replacement for coffee, but it's actually probable that it was an older drink in Europe than coffee, and coffee was more of, wow, this is a great kind of chicory, and it even has a kick.
All right, let's turn to Daniel in Rice Lake next. Daniel, hello to you.
Hello. One of my heroes was Ewell Gibbons, and I tried to teach people wild edibles with very little success. But my best student was one of my nephews, 3 years old, sitting in the middle of a feasting on a wild strawberry patch. He said, "These are even better than pork chops."
You know, thanks for calling, Daniel. There is a story, and you cover it and talk about it in your book, sort of a myth about Ewell Gibbons and how he died, and I'm kind of glad you try and clear that up in your book.
Yeah, you know, Ewell Gibbons is definitely one of my heroes as well, and when he was alive, I know people made fun of him quite a bit, and he was the butt of a lot of jokes, but he really was a serious naturalist, and did a lot. His stuff that he wrote, some of it is pretty amazing and pretty eloquent. But as soon as he died, there was a mythology that sprung up that he poisoned himself with eating the wrong plant. And I've heard this many, many times. I've even had people come up to me at a presentation I've given on edible wild plants and say something like, "You know, Ewell Gibbons died from this stuff," and it cracks me up. But it's kind of sad that it's more widely believed than the truth. We seem culturally to have a fear of edible wild plants, a fear of plant misidentification that's strong enough that we actually will make these stories up. And I call it the poisonous plant fable, and I've heard it a lot of times. And actually, now mushroom poisonings occur. There's you know, a number of fatal mushroom poisonings every year in the United States. A fatal poisoning from a misidentified plant, that occurs every 10 to 20 years. And that is, I mean, that's exceptionally rare when you consider how many people participate in that. And I would say that it's virtually always, if not always, the result of people ignoring the very simple, very basic rule of foraging safety that you don't eat a plant unless you're absolutely positive of what it is. And it sounds like a no-brainer, but there are, in fact, the reason that mushroom poisonings happen aren't because mushrooms are more dangerous than plants. They occur because there's more people who believe you don't need to identify them.
Uh-huh.
I regularly meet people at my workshops who think if you know two or three rules, or like any orange mushroom or any mushroom that grows on a tree is edible, or all of these rules are useless, whether or not they apply to mushrooms or to plants. But there's simply more people that believe that you can just memorize one simple rule and go out and collect mushrooms without identifying them, and that's a recipe for disaster.
Yeah. Samuel Thayer, our guest today, he is the author of a new book just out, Nature's Garden, A Guide to Identifying, Harvesting, and Preparing Edible Wild Plants. I hope you'll join in with your questions or comments as we move along today. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we'll take some more calls as we visit with Samuel Thayer about his new book, Nature's Garden. As I mentioned, he's from Birchwood, Wisconsin. Beautiful area of the state, as a matter of fact. I really enjoy that part of the state. And I'm so happy to have him with us today to answer your questions and to talk about his book. I tell you, his book, if you want to zero in on about 40 or so plants, edible wild plants, this would be a wonderful book for you to take a look at, because all of the plants, I think all but one of the plants he talks about in the book, are we find right here in Wisconsin. Jim in Wausau, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Just wondering how much nutrition is in dandelion greens. And also, if he has any ideas how to prepare cattail roots.
Okay.
Two good questions. You know, I can't give you the exact nutritional profile of dandelion greens, but they have been analyzed, and I believe you can get that online from the USDA. And, of course, it would vary from where they're harvested and the soil type and the time of year and all that. But they're extremely high in vitamins and minerals. And that can be said with confidence. There's probably few foods that you could find that were more nutritious than dandelion greens. And as a general thing, this is just kind of true as a blanket statement about wild foods. Whenever you compare a wild food to a similar cultivated food, the nutritional composition of the wild food tends to be dramatically higher. In fact, a lot of anthropologists, having noted this, believe that we are in a distinctly different nutritional state than people used to be in. People used to have just barely enough calories and plenty of all their vitamins and minerals, and now we have plenty of calories and just barely enough vitamins and minerals. As far as the cattail root, there's a lot of confusion about that because, the part that's eaten is actually not the root. It's the rhizome, which is an underground stem that stores starch. And depending on the stage of growth, it's eaten in two totally different ways. So generally in summer, especially late summer, the growing tip of this rhizome is very soft and tender. And once you get it out of the mud, you can clean it off, and you can eat it raw or cooked. It has a slightly cucumberish flavor, but it's much sweeter than a cucumber, and that's really my favorite vegetable on the cattail. And in fact, any person who likes vegetables would probably like that vegetable. It's just fantastic. But later in the season, when that rhizome matures, it will separate into two layers, a starchy core and then a spongy outer rind. That starchy core has a fish-line-like fiber in it, and you can definitely eat the starch that's in there. It's very nutritious and easy to digest, but you got to spit out these fish-line-like fibers, so it's a little bit more uncouth of a process to eat that.
All right. How much and you eat, frankly, you and your family, you eat a lot of wild plants, do you not?
Yeah, we do. I would say year-round, it's around half of our diet or so, and it depends on a lot of factors, what other projects are going on. And,
sure.
I mean, as we sit here, I'm shelling out hazelnuts that I cracked earlier, but I know I'm not supposed to be double-tasking while I'm talking to you. But, we eat quite a bit, and it's just fun. I don't tell people you should do this because it's good for you. It is good for you. I don't tell people, you should do this because it's. Some people do it like they feel like they ought to be foraging for the nutrition or something, and I do it because it's fun. All the other things are just benefits. But we eat a lot of wild food year round. We store nuts, and we store wild rice, and we can things, and we dry things, and so it's a lot of fun.
Joan in Rolling Ground will turn to you next. Hi, Joan.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
I have a question about a rule my mother taught me. I ate a lot of wild plants. She eats a lot of wild plants. She learned from her father, who learned from the Indians. She learned an awful lot on her own, so I trust her. And the rule she taught me was, if it has a square stem, it's safe. If you like it, you can eat it. You don't have to worry about trying it.
You know, I generally don't like rules like that. You can always find exceptions to them. So if it's a square, it's probably a mint. But it's not necessarily a mint. It could be something such as a common figwort, which is not edible. It's not going to kill you, but you definitely don't want to eat any. My response is that any such rule like that should simply be ignored. It depends on, you know, some people look at it as, is this going to kill me or not? That's not how I look at my food. Gravel won't kill you either, but there's no good reason to eat it.
Right.
The vast majority of plants with square stems are not going to harm you if you eat them in a small amount, but I just don't promote people eating random or semi-random things under any circumstances. So, it may be a nice rule to remember that it's probably not extremely poisonous if it has a square stem, but definitely identify a plant before you eat it.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot for calling, Joan. Appreciate it. And we have an email. Shane in Port Wing wonders, how to identify fiddlehead ferns from others that are not edible?
Well, that's a good question, and it's one of the most commonly asked questions I get. All ferns start with a fiddlehead shape. Instead of most plants have their shoot that's a pointed tip, their fern fiddleheads are coiled. And there are a number of species of large fern, and the primary ones that are collected are bracken fern and ostrich fern. Now, bracken fern absolutely must be cooked before it's eaten, because in the raw state, it has a fairly potent carcinogenic chemical in there. However, you know, it's a traditional food for millions of people, especially in Asia. But the most commonly collected one in Wisconsin is the ostrich fern. And this is actually one of the easiest edible wild plants to identify, in that I can tell you a few characteristics that are essentially make it unmistakable. So the ostrich fern is a large fern that grows in clumps as a rosette that eliminates like half the ferns or more. And it does not have a woolly or fuzzy coating on the fiddlehead. And the inside of the fiddlehead, the side facing the center, has a very deep groove. It's just like the groove you'd find in a celery stalk. So the ferns that are commonly confused with ostrich fern are cinnamon fern and interrupted fern. They're also large ferns that grow in rosettes, but they have the woolly outer coating, and they do not have a groove at all in the stem. And these ferns they're slightly bitter, and they're mildly toxic, but not dangerously toxic. And then lady fern and wood fern are marginally edible, and they have a shallow groove, so there's not really a danger of confusing lady fern and wood fern with the ostrich fern, but they both tend to be a lot smaller. So it's a pretty easy fern to identify, but there's a lot of people who believe that any fiddlehead is edible and just collect them, and so it's kind of a guessing game, and, oh, these fiddleheads are great, and, oh, these fiddleheads are terrible. But if you just remember, get down and feel the groove. If it's there, you've got the ostrich fern, and that's the right one.
Gina in Cuba City will turn to you next. Hi, Gina.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Good.
Good. I first want to say I'm a new listener to Wisconsin Public Radio. I recently moved here from Iowa, so I've switched my allegiance.
Oh, thank you.
This was a very interesting conversation. I have a couple questions, and then I'll take my response off the air, if that's okay.
Sure.
First of all, I have a yard full of dandelions. And Jim from Wausau kind of took my question, but I want to know how to prepare them. What do you recommend to prepare them? And how should I, get them from the lawn, pick them, wash them, of course. But what's a good way to prepare them? Then I want to know if you could recommend a good website for me to check online that would give me some ways to identify local plants and berries. And then I want to know, do you eat bugs?
I don't eat bugs, at least generally not on purpose.
Okay.
My rule with bugs is if somebody else was to prepare something with insects, I would try it. I've had a few insect things, but I do not go and collect insects on my own to eat. But I get asked that question, you know, I'm never cease to be shocked by how often I'm asked that. So people must be really afraid that I eat bugs. I don't know. As far as dandelions go, the first thing I want to say, and this is important, is that not everyone likes dandelions. You know, if you eat bitter salad greens, then you'll probably like dandelions. And I say bitter salad greens, I mean like escarole or some of the leaf lettuces. If you enjoy that, you'll probably enjoy dandelions. But if you don't, you probably won't. Now, there's a number of edible parts on dandelion, and the young leaves could be used raw in a salad, or they could be cooked. And they have a faint bitterness, which a lot of people, like me, get used to and really don't mind at all. But particularly the first time someone tries it, they often think, this is just too bitter for me to enjoy. It's a lot like escarole, if you've had that.
Yeah.
But another part of dandelion, not so well known, is just before, we're a little bit late for this year, but just before the flowers pop out of the ground, when the flower buds are actually at ground level or in the ground, you can take a spoon and gouge out the heart of the dandelion, which is these unopened flower buds. And that is, in my opinion, the best vegetable on the dandelion. And it's something you get in early spring when there's virtually no other vegetables to collect, particularly not in your yard. I don't know. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, we lost her. But then she wondered, too, about, well, of course, she wondered about identifying. In your book, Nature's Garden, you can certainly point to that as a book that will help you identify plants and prepare them. She wondered about a website or websites that might be available. You have one of your own, do you not, Sam?
Yeah, I do have a website, although I don't go into a lot of identification detail on the website. I would say for identifying plants, I don't think a website is the best way to go. A good one to use to confirm your identifications, I would look at the Wisconsin Herbarium website, and this will tell you if a plant is known to be found in your area and often will help you identify it or confirm your identification. And another one is, I think it's MissouriPlants.com, the best online identification site that I've seen. And there's a lot of plants in common between Wisconsin and Missouri. I mean, definitely some that aren't in common, but that's another one I would go to. But I would recommend getting two or three good field guides, Newcomb's Wildflower Guide, and using those.
Marlene in Twin Lakes wonders, what part of the dandelion plant do you use to make the wine?
Dandelion wine is made from the flowers.
Yes. So there you have it. And there are, I know there are many spots you can go online and many books that talk about how to make dandelion wine. Allison in Madison, on to you now. Hi, Allison.
Hi there. I have two questions today. My family and I have just started doing some morel hunting for the very first time. And I wondered, we found a couple, and being inexperienced, we sort of left them with the idea that maybe they would get bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And when we returned a day later, they seemed to have, instead of getting bigger, had died. So I was wondering, what if you see a morel, should you pick it right away? And, you know, how long do you have after you've seen a good one? And then I also wondered where I could pick up your book. And I could listen off the air.
All right. Well, if you see a morel and you want it, you should pick it. there are times where I will leave a morel, if I'm in an area I don't think anyone else is coming, and I'll be able to come back the next day or two, and you see a real small morel, you sort of develop an eye for, this morel is still growing. And they have a different look when they've reached their ultimate size. And if you leave them when they've reached their ultimate size, they're only going to deteriorate in quality. And, of course, then you increase the chance that somebody else or a deer is going to find them. So I definitely would pick it right away if I had any reason to believe it was close to its ultimate size. As far as where you can get my book, you can order it online through my website. You can get it through, certainly if your local bookstore doesn't have it, they can get it in for you. So I would recommend one of those two places.
And your website is?
Foragersharvest.com.
Foragers, so with an S, foragersharvest.com.
Yes.
Let's turn to Ken in Elkhorn next. Hi, Ken.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been into mushroom picking for probably 20 years. Recently, I found a sign in a consignment shop. It said mushroom licenses for sale. This is legitimate. It's pre-64 because it was before the DNR became the DNR. It was called the Conservation Commission. And have you ever heard of such a thing?
You know, I don't know anything about that. You know, in general, in Wisconsin, there's no licenses for foraging other than for ginseng collectors or wild rice harvesters. But I want to emphasize, too, I'm not a mushroom expert. There's a lot of people that know a lot more about mushrooms than I do. I do collect a number of mushrooms, for sure. But, yeah, I haven't heard of anything of that sort currently, and if it was from 64 or earlier, that's before my time, so I don't know.
Can't help you on that one, but thanks, Ken. Appreciate it. Nick in Ashland, on to you now.
I guess I just had a question for Sam about Juneberries.
Mm-hmm.
I was just wondering if you'd comment on the astounding variation in flavor there seemed to be.
Yeah, there is definitely an astounding variation in flavor. And the first thing to understand is that we have at least 5 species in northern Wisconsin. So there's the prize one is kind of the Amelanchier ulnifolia, which there's some debate about whether that's really in Wisconsin because the service berries tend to hybridize and look similar. Then there's another one called Sanguinea, which has good flavor. And one of the real common ones, the downy service berry, Amelanchier arborea, tends not to have a real good flavor, although sometimes it does. So within each species, they're quite variable, and the species themselves are variable. So for Juneberries or service berries, I just tell people just go out and taste them and pick the ones you like. we are lucky that we have good-tasting service berries in northern Wisconsin, and particularly on the Bayfield Peninsula, and really the whole clay plain along Lake Superior has very good service berries. I've picked service berries out in Washington State where they're unbelievably abundant and they're larger, and you can fill 5-gallon buckets with no problem, but they just don't have the same flavor they have here. And I've also picked service berries in northern Michigan where they were abundant, it seemed great, but their flavor was so lacking they were almost not worth picking. So we have really good service berry picking here in Wisconsin. So that's about all I can say as far as their flavor variation.
Okay. On to Adam in Rockford then. Adam, hello to you.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Sam, I have your Forager's Harvest book, and it's a great book, and I'm looking forward to getting your new book. I just wanted to make a comment about the you had mentioned the rhizomes from the cattail roots that could be eaten raw,
mm-hmm.
and I was just I know it's not extremely likely, and I've drank wild water before and not had any issues, but do you think that there's any reason that people should cook these anyway for waterborne bacteria, Giardia, things like that? Anything out of a lake or a pond, I suppose, has some chance of being contaminated. And I want to know your thoughts on that.
Well, this is another question I'm asked frequently. And if the surface is clean, it's safe. The inside of this living organism is sterile. There should be no bacteria or pathogenic organisms inside of the vegetable. You need to make sure that the surface is clean, though. So it's actually fairly simple. And I certainly wouldn't pull it right out of the mud and eat it. So just try to clean it in some potable water. And certain vegetables are hard to thoroughly clean, but these cattail lateral rhizomes, when they're young, have a smooth outer surface. They're very easy to thoroughly clean.
All right, there you have it. Thanks for calling. Dee in Gays Mills wonders if the roots of the wild parsnip are essentially the same as the cultivated parsnip vegetable.
I am so happy that she asked that question. And the answer is absolutely yes, just slightly better. They average slightly smaller, but they're also slightly sweeter and have a slightly better flavor. Now, when I was a kid, if you said you had a parsnip rash, nobody knew what you were talking about, and they looked at you like you were crazy, and doctors diagnosed this parsnip rash as poison ivy or in more silly than that, poison oak, which doesn't grow anywhere east of the Rockies. Now the parsnip rash is very well known, and the DNR kind of advertises that this plant causes a rash. Well, to many people's surprise, the cultivated parsnip causes exactly the same rash as the wild parsnip. And so in harvesting the root, whether it's a cultivated plant or a wild plant, you tend not to expose yourself to the juice of the plant, which is what causes the rash. So I have collected wild parsnips since I was 14 years old, and I have never gotten the rash from collecting wild parsnips, even though they cause it. And I also grow parsnips in my garden. I've never got the rash from collecting those. So it's really not an issue if you're careful and you understand that it's the juice of the plant on your bare skin that causes the rash.
Dorothy in Black Creek emailed in to say, has anyone mentioned that wild plants grow on private land unless they're state, national, or local parks where you're not supposed to pick the foliage, and that the forager should ask permission from the landowner before venturing into the woods and pastures that look so tempting? Could be a trespass issue.
Definitely. And again, it's like any other outdoor activity. Whether you're bird watching, hunting, fishing, you need to have permission before you would access private land. There are public lands where you can forage, and sometimes what you can forage is limited. Like in the state parks and the state forests, you can collect nuts and berries, fruits, mushrooms for your own consumption. But it's great to just get to know a landowner, and as long as they're not protecting some ginseng or some morels, they're very likely to give you permission to collect on their property. And it's a great way to get to know somebody.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, your book, it's Nature's Garden, A Guide to Identifying, Harvesting, and Preparing Edible Wild Plants. And you should be able to order it from your local bookstore or go online to your website. And what, again, Sam, is your website?
That's foragersharvest.com.
Foragers, and that's with an S, foragersharvest.com.
Yes.
Sam, great pleasure. I hope we can do this again.
Yeah, well, nice talking to you.
Thank you so much. Samuel Thayer, Birchwood, Wisconsin is his home. And he's he's from Birchwood, but he's an internationally recognized authority on edible wild plants. He does a lot of speaking. He produces maple syrup, and he's a wild rice harvester, teaches classes. And his book is a fascinating book with a lot of great photography to help you in identifying 41 edible wild plants. 41, and how to pick them and what happens with them and how do you prepare them. So all that is in the book. Coming up, we're going to be talking about another book, and this one happens to do with the shipwrecks of southeastern Wisconsin. Brendan Baylod of Marshall, Wisconsin, recognized authority on Great Lakes marine antiquities, and is the author of Wisconsin's Lost Ships. Coming up next on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.